Hey everybody, this is Steerpike from Tap Repeatedly. I'm here with my good friend Ben Hoyt. He's worked in the games industry for a lot of years on a number of projects. Ben and I have wanted to do a discussion on the Mass Effect series for quite some time now. And since the firestorm over the trilogy's ending has finally kind of died down, it's had a chance to marinate in our minds for a while. It seemed like the right time. We're also going to talk about Halo 4, Ben is going to talk about it since my Xbox has died for the seventh time and I haven't been able to play it, so I wasn't able to do my homework. But, Ben, welcome.
Thanks. How's it going?
Let's start by having you introduce yourself for the listeners who don't know you.
As you mentioned, I've been making video games now for a little over 10 years. Got my start in the industry in Chicago at High Voltage Software back in the Xbox and PlayStation 2 days. I produced a kids card battling game in the sort of Yu-Gi-Oh! And Pokemon genre for them called Duel Masters, based off of an IP at Wizards of the Coast, and then spent some time working on a Leisure Suit Larry game that sadly never saw the light of day. It was a personal frustration for me to this day. It would have been a really good game. And then I went over to EA, touched very briefly on Fight Night Round 3, spent most of my time there on Def Jam Icon, and then moved back to California, where I worked for about a year and a half at Emergent Game Technologies and was in charge of basically managing the creation of product demos for their Gamebryo game engine. And then I went over to Paramount Pictures in their digital entertainment group and produced a handful of very early iOS iPhone games, as well as an XBLA title called Star Trek DAC, which was also an excellent learning experience that I got to do with the guys over at Bad Robot in relation to the new film. And then went really started focusing more on mobile increasingly. Spent some time at EA Mobile on a brief contract and then at Atari for about a year before starting my own company at the beginning of 2012. Hopefully I am very, very close to signing a publishing deal for a little mobile game that I designed with an unannounced publishing partner, and then we'll be off to the races. But one of the things that really since I was at Paramount has been a focus for me has been this idea of what's called transmedia. Is that a buzzword that has inherent meaning for you and your listeners?
I don't know. I haven't heard it, but it sounds good.
So the idea behind transmedia, and I mention it because I do think it's relevant to some of the stuff we're going to talk about, is that historically entertainment properties have been created with a single medium in mind and then have been effectively ported over to other media when they seemed like they would be a fit or when there was an economic incentive to do so. And, you know, we've seen countless examples of this in which really the primary examples that I like to focus on are basically films that are based off of video games or video games that are based off of films. And in both cases, you know, the track record is spotty, to say the least. The film industry has not done a great job of recreating their favorite properties as movies. And I think that, you know, similarly, there have been countless disappointing video game adaptations of films that seem like they should make for good video games. And this has been a challenge that is really, I think, vexed and perplexed people for a long time. And having been one of a relatively small number of people who's now worked, you know, has a strong background on the video game side of things and at least has worked inside of the movie industry, and having lived here in Los Angeles and built the sort of professional network that I have of people in the film world, particularly since I was at Paramount, I've been just giving this stuff a lot of thought, and I'm a firm believer that that it's a solvable problem. There's no good reason in my mind why you know, there shouldn't have been an absolutely fantastic Avatar video game available when the movie launched, or why you know, why we haven't yet seen fantastic movies based off of franchises like Halo and World of Warcraft and Gears of War and so on and so forth. Of course, I understand why those things haven't happened so far, but I think my point is that I think that's a solvable problem. And so the solution is this concept called transmedia, and it's really just a buzzword that gets thrown around a lot, and it means different things to different people, so it's somewhat imperfect. But the idea is basically that the solution, or at least a big part of the solution, is to break this cycle of creating an entertainment property for a single medium and then, you know, not thinking about how it's going to extend itself into other media until after the fact, and to have that conversation really from the beginning, at the inception of the property, and talk about a strategy and a plan for, you know, how will this be able to be a successful film, TV show, video game, comic book, novel, you know, so on and so forth. And when you start talking about games like Mass Effect and Halo, I think it becomes particularly relevant because they're not only AAA, very successful games, but they're games that have a strong narrative element, as well as a strong and unique fictional universe and setting.
Well, it makes a lot of sense in that context, because Halo and Mass Effect are probably two of the games that many people in the games industry, at the very least, would really go out of their way to call cinematic. And the movies have been around a lot longer, but there are differences. Games are interactive, movies aren't, comics aren't, but it does seem like we'd have fewer problems making those crossovers. So I think actually Mass Effect is a pretty good place to start with a transmedia kind of discussion. I believe that there is a movie either in development hell or in early stages of script writing for Mass Effect. So I guess we'll see where that goes.
Lots of AAA game properties have been successful in getting sort of the rights purchased to them for making a movie. But honestly, that's almost the beginning of the end. in terms of what I think is likely to see them, you know, actually ever see the light of day in a way that is both commercially successful and satisfactory to the fans, because really the licensing business model is so flawed when it comes to trying to do this sort of thing. And you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with these projects. I'm not surprised that they have, you know, gotten no further than development hell. I mean, most of them have, you know, gone through a number of directors and writers that have been attached to them without getting any further than that. And I'll be interested to see if they can come out of the existing business model as quality products. But I'm skeptical.
Yeah, I think that skepticism is probably wise. You know, it's funny. I feel kind of like we've come full circle here. You and I met in 2005. We had breakfast at the Game Developers Conference in California, and then we hung out again in 2006 at the Austin Game Developers Conference. And that was the first time, I was just thinking back, that we talked about Mass Effect. It hadn't shipped then, and actually not that much was known about it. It was one of the reasons I bought an Xbox, because my PC at the time was kind of old, and that was one of the games I really wanted to play. I love BioWare's work, and I remember we were sitting around talking about Mass Effect, and you said, I've heard the combat is going to be kind of like Gears of War, which mm-hmm. really intrigued me. I mean, that was, I hadn't heard anything really, aside from the fact that it's just sort of a sci-fi space opera. I hadn't heard much beyond that, and I remember thinking, holy crap, that could be awesome, because BioWare mm-hmm. had done at least one shooter. They did MDK2, so they had some experience, and I figured this plus, you know, their shooter experience plus their role-playing game experience could really result in something potentially very awesome. And now that it's closed, I think we're there.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, Mass Effect is a trilogy of games, and it did come out, you know, the first Mass Effect did come out relatively early in the Xbox 360's life cycle. And, you know, it's a very interesting case study for a lot of things about the games industry and the nature of game development and particularly in how you can observe the evolution of the game from Mass Effect 1 to Mass Effect 3. I was also very excited for Mass Effect, and the first Mass Effect game to me was an enormous disappointment. The list of criticisms I had about that game was a mile long, and the first time I tried to get into it. I think I played about 10 or 15 hours and just threw up my hands in frustration and disgust and walked away. And it actually prompted me to write a blog post, which you can find on my blog. The blog post was called "It's Time for Movie Mode." And basically the incentive behind it was a combination of experiences that I'd had with Mass Effect, Grand Theft Auto, and something else around the same time, probably BioShock, where I felt like we had reached a point where games had proven that they could be successful and effective from a narrative perspective in conveying compelling stories. And in fact, some games, the three that I just mentioned, and BioShock is another long-running conversation you and I have had, but the three that I just mentioned are all examples of games that, to me, by 10 hours into them, I was done playing them. I just really didn't feel like the gameplay was sufficiently engaging that I wanted to continue investing the time. But by that point, I had gotten interested in the story and the characters and what would happen with them. And, you know, right now the best you can do is sort of go online and, you know, see if someone's been kind enough to post some bootleg copies of the cinematic sequences so you can try and piece together what happened, or perhaps read a Wikipedia summary or something like that. But the article that I wrote was really an attempt to make a case for an in-game feature that would allow you to basically tell the game to play itself on an AI mode. And let you just sit there and watch the game play itself out, so you didn't have to deal with the hassle of, you know, mind-numbing side quests in Mass Effect 1, or running around taking your best friend to the pool hall in Grand Theft Auto, or things like that, and you could just sort of follow the gist of the story, or even really frustrating sequences in a game that might cause you to have to die and reboot over and over and over again. But basically the ability to say, okay, so I'm interested in the story, but I've gotten my fill of playing it, I'm going to go ahead and watch it play out. And ironically enough, I found an article basically saying that Miyamoto had filed a patent for what was effectively an identical implementation about 3 days before I published my blog post. I was irritated about it.
That was your chance. That was your chance, yeah, at riches. Well,
it was both frustrating and flattering. I'll say that. So it was. Basically, to me, you know, getting back to the Mass Effect conversation, it's a series that when I talk to people now, I say by all means, I consider it one of the greatest achievements of all time in video game history, and I love the series. But what I tell people is, if you haven't played it before, you really should play Mass Effect 1 through, so that you get that story experience, and because of the whole character import process, so you can have your decisions, you know, carry over into the subsequent games. But just skip everything outside of the main quest line, because the rest of that game is just so unbearable.
Yeah. Get it done and know the story, because to appreciate it, you really have to have the whole arc.
Yeah,
I think it'd be hard to go in at two. And you know, just for hi mom, the people who might be listening to this but haven't played the game, let's try and tag team very quickly the overall story and plot line of Mass Effect. I guess at the highest level, the Mass Effect series is. It's set in about the year 2200, I want to say. It's generally a story about humanity's integration with galactic culture. Humans, their space travel and so forth have advanced over time, and they discover, first of all, a cache of artifacts on Mars, if I recall correctly, from what they believe to be an ancient extinct race called the Protheans, which give them a lot more knowledge, a lot more technology. And then outside of the orbit of Pluto, which was still a planet back then, they discover this giant artificial structure, which is called a mass relay. And it turns out that these objects are scattered throughout the galaxy, and they allow far faster than light travel. They're essentially almost instant teleportation of your craft to any other mass relay. And that's the only way that the intelligent cultures in the galaxy can interact. They have faster than light travel, but even with faster than light, you're not going to get very far in a galaxy our size. Yeah. So the particularly the first one is humans are fairly new on the scene, and they're interacting with more than a dozen other intelligent races, some of which are fairly humanoid and some of which are very, very different, which kind of leads to the other thing that I always thought Mass Effect was about, which is racism.
You know, it's interesting. As a writer, I imagine you probably spend a lot more time paying attention to the thematic elements like that than I do. And I think that one of the things that really impressed me about Mass Effect, one of the things that I think really sets it apart, and one of the things that makes it actually a strong candidate for transmedia treatment, is the amount of time and thought that was clearly put into the underlying science and rules of the fictitious universe that it takes place in. It's one of these things where and I really respect this kind of fiction, where if you can sort of accept a single fictitious leap, in this case that this Mass Effect technology exists and allows for the type of sort of manipulation of matter and energy that it says that it allows for in the fiction, the whole rest of the universe is coherent and holds together in that context, all the way down to the nature of the different ship types that have evolved to be common in interstellar space combat, and the complications of weapons such as mass drivers versus lasers versus missiles, and how that manifests itself in ship-to-ship tactical combat. All of that stuff is logically consistent and holds together, and presented and available to you in the game to read and familiarize yourself with. And that to me was just a really cool piece of the Mass Effect universe, is that journal system that they have there, and all the thought that's gone into how the whole universe operates once this technology becomes available.
There are thousands and thousands of words in each game has a codex, which goes mm-hmm. over all the races. It goes over the technology, and I mean, you don't get a PhD in physics from it or anything, but they did think it through. There's this discovery of this substance called element zero, which is the element before hydrogen, which is what is used essentially to create a mass effect, which turns out to be an elemental force like the strong and weak nuclear forces and gravity and electromagnetism, and it's what allows this travel. So all these cultures are kind of getting together, and there's the beginnings of a galactic government. I was always fascinated by all of that because it didn't require that much suspension of disbelief. I doubt any of it's physically possible, but it worked. And, right. You know, I remember just some of the dialogue, like, you're on this ship called the Normandy, which is a very, very advanced ship, initially built by the humans, which is a stealth ship, and they spend some time talking about that. And it's not cloaking technology like in Star yeah. Trek, but, you know, yeah. I remember your pilot says, no, we're not invisible, but unless someone goes to the window and looks out and sees us, yeah. the sensors are not going to see us. And all these little things that show a whole universe of the science part of science fiction really, really built in. And you play a character called Commander Shepard, who has no first name because you can choose to be a male or female Shepard, depending on how you choose to play. And Shepard is the first human being to become what's called a Council Spectre. The Council is it's a three-person galactic executive body that's sort of the presidency and Congress all rolled into one of the early galactic government. And humans desperately want to have a place on the council, but three races that have been around in the galactic community a lot longer hold those positions. And Spectres are sort of they're special agents who operate well above any galactic law, and essentially their job is to just kind of hang around until the council needs them to do something. And whether it's negotiate a trade alliance or stop a war or start a war or deal with very, very large things, they have absolute freedom.
Yeah, I mean, they're sort of the I mean, you know, Mass Effect is clearly a series built on the shoulders of giants, and they're sort of the Jedi of the Mass Effect universe, I think, you know, and perhaps a slightly less mystical and more formalized capacity.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's, you know, all governments, even on Earth, have these, you know, sort of special agents that can get away with a lot, and your opportunity to become one it's confusing at first. I remember in the first Mass Effect, there's, like any RPG, they throw a huge amount of information at you at the very beginning, and I'm still thinking, okay, who's that? What? Why do you have tentacles on your head? What is that blue person over there? What's going on? And it's really several hours into the game that you learn the overarching conflict, which is that for reasons that aren't made clear for three games, basically, there's this race of mechanical beings called the Reapers that apparently every 50,000 years come into the Milky Way, destroy all intelligent life, and then leave. And yeah. Then float around outside the galaxy.
Although it becomes clear later that they don't really destroy all intelligent life, they just destroy all spacefaring species or something to that effect.
That's right.
Because obviously humanity has been around for more than 50,000 years, and it later becomes revealed at the climax of the third game that the Reapers were created by the organic species at the beginning. To prevent them from becoming supplanted by synthetic life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you spend a lot of time. I remember when Mass Effect 3 ended. You know, even after I finished the game and I understand what the Reapers were doing and why they were doing it, there's a lot about it that didn't 100% makes sense to me, and you sort of get the feeling that maybe it doesn't 100% make sense to the Reapers, but that's their purpose, and mm-hmm. they're intelligent robots, and it becomes this sort of, in addition to the biological racism, there's this organic versus synthetic concept, and the whole thing is built into, you know, Mass Effect is famous for its treatment of choice. I mean, the way you behave, the way you talk to people, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of conversations, and each really dictates your path through the game. And it can be amazingly different depending on the choices you've made.
That level of agency and the ability to affect what happens in the game and have such a wildly different experience of the game based on the decisions you make is one of one of the great achievements of the Mass Effect series. It's also, ironically enough, one of the things that I think is going to make it really challenging to make a Mass Effect movie because there's so little in terms of, you know, canon, in terms of what happens in Mass Effect that everybody can agree actually happened, right? I mean,
yeah.
all the way down to at the end of the first game, and spoiler alert, you know, whether or not you allow the council to be wiped out or you save them, and what the long-term effect that has on humanity's political relationship, you know, I saved the council and continued on, as if they, you know, they were rescued. I created a second character to play the game in the more sort of renegade path, and apparently that canonically is not what happened. If you do that, the council has been wiped out at the end of the first Mass Effect.
It's funny. I played the first Mass Effect on the Xbox 360, and then, you know, later on I upgraded my PC, and obviously God intended games to be played on the PC, so I switched over in Mass Effect 2 and couldn't import my saves. And it was really interesting that had happened. I made the decision to let the council die, actually, but practically every other decision I made, by basically, as far as the game was concerned, starting with Mass Effect 2, had been reversed. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a weird situation, because I felt like I knew the Shepard that I had been playing. I'd made a lot of decisions. Only one other major decision, essentially, that I had made had survived, in terms of which of, mm-hmm. you know, you have an opportunity
to save
a certain character, and you got to choose which one. And I'd made the other decision, and it stuck with that.
Who did you save? I'm just curious.
I saved Ashley, and you know,
I mean, always save the girl. That's my
always
philosophy.
Save the girl. I played a dude, and. Because there are romance options in the game too, and you know, it's funny, Ashley Williams is one of the first characters you meet who joins your squad, and
yeah,
you know, I remember reflecting back on it, she's kind of a bitch, and
yeah,
she's kind of, I mean, there's no kind of about it, she's a bigot, she's an absolute huge racist who hates almost all alien life, which pretty much offends, you know, every liberal sensibility I've got. But she's an attractive human female. and I know there's this romance storyline in Mass Effect, right. So I was curious to try it out. And the other romantic interest, and, you know, this is maybe going to betray my unknown racist tendencies. I don't know. The other option is this blue, Liara. You know, it's Liara Tassoni. She's an Asari, which are these blue tentacle headed scientist women. They have no men, and the way they reproduce is very unusual, to say the least, and they're psychics, mm-hmm. and they're very ethereal, and it's like, and Liara is really nice. Liara is intelligent, and mm-hmm. she's always kind of got your back as soon as you meet her. And the whole time I was like, okay, well, when Ashley is in a position where the other character who might die is a guy who I never really warmed to. His name is Caden Alenko. He's just kind of a douche wicket, and I never got attached to him, so it wasn't a hard choice, partly because I wanted to bone Ashley and partly because it's like, you know, I don't really like you, and I talk to you in the kitchen of the ship every now and then, and it's...
Yeah, I mean, Caden was just sort of, I mean, I never anything against Caden. He was just never a particularly interesting character. Ashley was pretty much unlikable for me throughout the whole series, but... I don't remember why I chose to save Ashley over Caden in particular. It probably came down to her being a chick. If I'm being honest, I don't really know. But I was way more interested in Liara throughout the first game, and I ended up with Liara at the end of the third game. Although I had a really wonderful break with Miranda in the second game. So.
There was a lot of controversy because this is certainly not the first game to include romance options, and it's not the first BioWare game to include romance options. But it was. BioWare is a little clumsy in some of these things, the way it handles romance. And I think it was a little clumsy in the way it handled romance in the Mass Effect series, in part because it wasn't until the third game that they even seriously considered, aside from kind of faking it, the idea of gay relationships. You know, if you play a female Shepard, Liara is a woman, but the Asari don't have any men. They reproduce asexually. They reproduce with other races. It's kind of okay. You can be a lesbian, but we're not gonna really go crazy with it because we wouldn't want Fox News to get upset. So we're just gonna kind of write in this cop out. And
well, I mean, I think that's being a little bit harsh on BioWare. I mean, you gotta remember it was. 2005 was a very different time than 2012, and I think that thankfully we've come a long way on that subject, and I was really pleased to see them support that in the third game, but I'm not particularly appalled by the way they handled it in either of the first two.
You know, something I think that they handled incredibly well, and in fact probably better than almost any other game I've ever played, was friendships. You know, they may have been a little clumsy with romance, but you make friends with a lot of these characters and a lot of them return.
Sure.
And I remember, you know, a lot of the time in terms of choosing your squads, when you have, you know, what they'd call in Star Trek an away mission, you choose who comes with you, and it's usually two others. And I spent a lot of time kind of, well, I like these people the most, and I trust these people the most, but at the same time, I don't want them to die. So, you know, and this was funny in Mass Effect 2, because a lot of people consider that one the best. I liked it a lot. My fundamental problem with Mass Effect 2 was I liked practically everyone who was with me in Mass Effect. And mm-hmm. in 2... I love the improvements they made to the game engine. I love the improvements they made to controls and so mm-hmm. much more. But I hated practically everyone on my crew who wasn't from the first. So, I wound up always going on every mission with Garrus Vakarian, who's a Turian. They're sort of lizard mm-hmm. bird people. And is really, for most players, I think is kind of your bro, he's your best friend in a lot of ways, and Tally, who is she's a member of the Quarian race, and they have their own unique problems.
And man, just to get to the this is a moment, and we're jumping around a little bit, but just mentioning Tally kind of tugs at my heartstrings a little bit because, in Mass Effect 3, I don't know. I you know, one of the things that's really interesting to me is, you know, I haven't gone online and extensively researched all the alternative options that I could have taken in terms of the decisions that I made. But so I don't know whether or not it was possible. But Tali dies in Mass Effect 3 for me.
Oh yeah.
And it was, I didn't mean for her to die. I didn't want for her to die. She was one of my favorite characters, and I had really been hoping that I'd be able to explore the romantic option with her, because at a minimum, I understand you get to see her face when you do that.
You do, yeah.
But the problem was her idiot Quarian people and their insistence on trying to annihilate the Geth, even when they weren't, you know, when they were doomed, you know, and at the end of that sequence, in my playthrough, you know, you basically have to decide, do I give the Geth the information that they need to fight back against the Quarians, or do I let the Quarians wipe them out? And this is an example of what I felt was like the really brilliant, and they did this several times in Mass Effect 3, the really just brilliant decision-making dilemmas that they would present you with, because, you know, it's obvious that the Quarians are going to throw away their entire species in the attempt to wipe out the Geth. And if you give the Geth the codes, that's exactly what's going to happen. And yet I couldn't morally sit there and rationalize to myself letting the Geth get wiped out, who are, you know, effectively a new and sentient artificial life form at the hands of the Quarians. And so I gave Legion the permission to upload the information that he was supposed to upload to make the Geth, you know, fully functional. And Tali literally just turns around, takes off her mask, and drops off a cliff afterwards, because she knows her entire race is going to get wiped out. And I stopped. I went back to a previous save. I rebooted. I was like, there's one of those QuickTime moments where you could hit a button or something. Maybe if I'd have just hit that sooner, I would have caught her or something like that. You know, like I went, and you can't. And I was just like, but I'm not going to let the whole Geth species, which will be a huge asset in the fight against the Reapers, and it turns out is, you know, worth a lot of points in the sort of galactic readiness score that you need to have. I'm not going to let them just get completely obliterated by these crazy Quarians, you know, because that's what, I don't know, it was one of the more upsetting moments in my playthrough.
It's really funny, and this is an example of how different and this feeds into your transmedia theories, because Everybody's game is very different. Tali was my girlfriend in Mass Effect 2, and I stuck with her in 3, because I'm a sucker for Eastern European accents to begin with, and she was just so awesome.
She's got a rocking body, too.
She really does. She's hot, and I'll tell you what, she may be straight out of iStock photo, but she's hot under the mask too. And it's with the Geth are this robotic race that were originally created by the Quarians, who are this sort of bookish engineering type of race, and they're artificially intelligent robots. They rise up against their masters and nearly destroy the Quarians. They lose
which you learn in Mass Effect 3 they only do because the Quarians are intent on pulling the plug on all of them.
Yeah, the Geth are treated kind of like cars. You know, you have a problem, you recall it. You have a problem, you turn it in and get a new one. And the uprising of the Geth leads to billions of Quarian deaths early on. The Quarians lose their home planet. They lose their immune systems because they don't have a home planet that allows them to develop one. So they have to live in these hermetically sealed suits that keep them safe. And the Geth are a real threat. They're one of the great antagonists in the first Mass Effect. But at the same time, this is an entire race of sentient artificial intelligence. When they rose up, the Galactic Council started issuing a series of laws about how far you could go with AI just to prevent that from happening again. And then you're in this situation where one of the Geth, who's sort of disconnected from their network, his name is Legion, you've defeated them militarily, and he has these codes that he could upload to his people that he believes would let them sort of enter galactic society as equals. And, you know, it's funny because Tali was my romance option in the game, and she's standing right there. Mm-hmm. In that scene when he's asking for it, and the option is it's an absolutely binary option. It's give the Geth this capability or let the Quarians annihilate them.
Yeah.
And I mean, so it's basically, do you commit genocide or don't you? And you're sitting there
for your girlfriend.
And you're sitting there asking yourself, okay, well, you know, is it genocide to destroy all all toaster ovens in the world. But these things are not toaster ovens. You know, I mean, Legion goes so far as to ask you if you think he has a soul.
Right.
And it's not even
fair to say it's just for your girlfriend. I mean, there are legitimate and weighty issues about, saving the Geth and what that means for the safety of the rest of the organic species in the galaxy. And, you know, at the same time, the issue of who's going to be more helpful with the immediate threat, which is the Reapers, who've already attacked and are intent on killing everything. So who do you want to have on your side? It was a fantastic example of putting the player in a difficult decision situation, and second, in my opinion, only to the very last decision in the game.
There's another semi-genocidal situation that happens, and it's discussed all through the three games. There's a race called the Krogan, which are sort of frog lizard people, and they've been on the scene like everybody else long before humans. The Krogan are very warlike. They're very large and physically imposing, very dangerous, and they also breed like bunnies. And the species in the galaxy kind of raise them up beyond their technological level to get them to help in another war that happens about 1,000 years before humans even come onto the scene, and then the Krogans become a problem because there are so many of them, and so two of the other races develop a biological weapon that essentially blocks their reproduction. So something like 1 in 10,000 Krogan is born alive, which seems...
Or I think it's only 1 in 10,000 women are fertile or something along those lines.
It seems terrible, but of course, you know, like every Krogan woman has 10,000 Krogan babies, so they cut the population down to size, but it's this thing called the genophage. It's a bioweapon that was developed, and you just hear about it, and the Krogan are obviously very angry about it and have been for a long time. Then in Mass Effect 3, you have a situation where you can reverse it, and that's another huge decision because it's militarily against the Reapers. The Krogan would be a huge military asset, and the whole point of Mass Effect 3 is you're gathering galactic military capabilities for this massive counterattack against the Reapers. So you're constantly weighing these decisions. You know, am I going to save the Krogan, even knowing that they're going to be a problem if we defeat the Reapers, or do I?
And you have a similar question in Mass Effect 2 when you discover the Rachni Queen, and you have to decide if you're going to rescue her. And the question, the same basic question, rears its head again, which is if you save this race, they may become a threat in the future, as they've proven that they can be in the past. But you know, do you have the right to, to make that decision? And consistently, in all three cases, I saved the races, and in all three cases, they turned out to be large and valuable assets in the fight against the Reapers. But you never know, if Mass Effect 4 comes out a few years from now, what the consequences will be. But I think that making these kinds of ethical dilemmas tangible is one of the great accomplishments of the game. In addition to, because it's a macro issue as opposed to what the games also do really well, which is create these very micro interpersonal relationships that you care about in terms of your relationship, particularly with characters like Garrus and Rex and Liara and so on and so forth. But also they force you to tackle really big, weighty, ethical issues, which I think is really impressive.
You know, we're learning about each other here because this conversation has proven that you're a good person and I'm a bad person. Because as you say that, I realize you're actually given the opportunity to commit genocide three times in the Mass Effect series. The Rachni are an insect race that the Krogan were uplifted to fight. And in the first Mass Effect, you meet what is essentially the last living Rachni. And you have... You're, again, binary choice. Do you kill her or do you let her go? And so it occurs to me that I reversed the genophage, but I killed the Rachni Queen and I killed all the Geths. And so
you're arguably Hitlerian in your
I guess I am. You're 3 for 3 saving, and I'm one for three.
But, you know, at the end of the day, I may just be naive and foolish because, I mean, you know, there's nothing that would have said that in Mass Effect 3 the Arachnid didn't come back and try and wipe everybody out again. You know, I mean, there was no, you know, predicting the future on that. And it's easy to make that kind of call when you're dealing with video game, you know, species. It's not so... You know, it's understandable, I think, to be a little bit more wary if it were the real world. It's like if, you know, this race had... the Arachnid really are funny because they're kind of a... In my mind, they were kind of a nod to Ender's Game and the same enemy species that Ender had to face and decide what to do with in that book. And...
And of course, you know, was sort of tricked
but he was also vilified after. If you read the following three books, he was tricked, but he did effectively wipe out the alien species, and he was referred to as the Xenocide for the rest of his life. You know, and society largely regretted that they had. Taking that path.
Well, you know, you talked about predicting the future. So in Mass Effect, let's talk a little about predicting the past, because another major story arc is this race of creatures called Protheans. They existed during what's called the last cycle, which is the previous 50,000 years, the last time the Reapers came in and destroyed all spacefaring life. And all through the games, you keep finding Prothean artifacts. You keep finding Prothean technology. And it's interesting because this was very deft of BioWare that they kind of present the Protheans, and they never present it. You just sort of assume it, that the Protheans were very intelligent, that they were a peaceful people, that they did their best against the Reapers. And then when Mass Effect 3 came out, there was a Day Zero downloadable content called From Ashes that gives you the last living Prothean, that gives you access to him. And I remember thinking,
God, he's such an insufferable dick.
He is, and I remember thinking, boy, I'm stupid. Here, all through three games, I've been listening to scientists, and I've been thinking about it myself. And these Protheans were wonderful, and if only we had a Prothean now. And then you meet a Prothean, and you realize there's nothing. They were brutal. They were tyrannical. They were genocidal. They were warlike. They were slavers. They were as flawed as every other living thing. And they, in the minds of the civilizations of the galaxy in the Mass Effect series, they were this wonderful, almost godlike species that could not do any wrong. And then you meet one, and he's like, "No, we didn't. We killed anybody who didn't side with us." And I remember thinking, boy, that we were never given any evidence that the Protheans were good. We just had all this technology from them.
You know, and what's interesting to me is I was more neutral on the Protheans. I didn't really make any assumptions about what their culture was like or their personality. So when I learned that, I think I was perhaps a little surprised, but I don't think I had quite the reaction you had, because I was just like, all they were to me was, and this is sort of where the conversation I had in mind, you know, has a potential to bridge over to Halo a little bit, was that they have a lot in common with the Forerunners in the Halo universe, with the idea being that that they were this sort of early, before us race that sort of seeded the galaxy with amazing technology and put life everywhere, and then, you know, it went extinct for unknown reasons. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting about Mass Effect 3 was that it turns out that that's not true either, that they were, you know, one of many, many, many incarnations of this cycle that's been going on countless, you know, has repeated itself countless times. And, you know, that the Citadel and the Mass Effect relays predated the Protheans as well.
That was a great revelation, that you find the mass relays, and they're the key to galactic civilization throughout the whole thing. Without the mass relays and without this giant space station called the Citadel that is the seat of galactic government, everybody assumes the Protheans built that stuff. And I remember also the revelation in 3 from Javik, who's the Prothean character. Once again, it's like, no, we didn't build the mass relays.
we didn't build that
the We found it. The Reapers built that stuff. And the Reapers, in fact, sort of made galactic civilization possible in some ways by building all these tools. The mass relays in particular, you realize about a third of the way through Mass Effect 3, that the mass relays are not some, gateway to allow galactic civilization. They're a tool the Reapers use to get around the galaxy more effectively so they can wipe out all spacefaring life as quickly as possible.
You know, it wasn't ever, I mean, that's true, but it wasn't ever clear to me. My understanding was that the Citadel and the Mass Effect and the mass relays were created by whatever was the first organic species that achieved this sort of transcendent level of technology, who also created the Reapers, but that the Reapers then had to turn on and wipe out their creators, and that the Reapers, like the relay and the Citadel, were a product of an ancient organic race. But maybe I misunderstood that.
I'm not sure. I'll have to check my facts, and I'll edit this out if we're completely off base on this. But I recall Javik saying explicitly, the Reapers built the mass relay. So he might not have known, which is major thing, because this has been going on every 50,000 years, and the Protheans don't know really any more than you do at your time, which is, and that actually leads to an interesting point of discussion about the ending of Mass Effect 3. One of the problems I had with it, and I didn't have many problems with the ending as it stood, was, you keep finding this technology, and so here I am under the impression now that the mass relays had been built by the Reapers and the Citadel had been built by the Reapers. And one of the more ham-handed sci-fi elements that I didn't like in Mass Effect 3 is you find plans for this ancient super weapon called the Crucible. And it's like, oh, we got to build the Crucible. If we build the Crucible, everything will be fine. We'll destroy the Reapers. Everything will be fine. It'll be awesome. And I remember as soon as I came to the conclusion that the Reapers had built the mass relays, I remember thinking, oh shit, the Crucible, this is just another bait and switch by the Reapers. It's going to be a Reaper, or it's going to be a Reaper tool that they're going to use to turn on us. And it actually turned out to not be those things. I think that was kind of an opportunity missed by BioWare. They chose this very cliched ancient alien super weapon to maybe solve the problem.
I agree that it was a little ham-handed. I like the way they rationalized it, that it was a super weapon that had basically been incrementally developed throughout these different cycles, that the Crucible was something that each subsequent cycle had discovered and added, gotten closer to creating and added to the design of, but no one had ever succeeded in really getting it fully operational in time. And you saw even in the case of Mass Effect 3, Liara contingency plans for that, right? Like, she does the whole Shadow Broker thing where she says, like, we may not succeed at this. I need to make sure that the progress that we've made is available for the next cycle. And she goes out and does that, which I thought was cool. But, I think that, if you're going to accept that the Reapers are as overwhelmingly powerful as they're supposed to be, which is to me was one of the hardest things to deal with in the series, because you're constantly fighting them and winning, and so the idea that the entire galaxy's spacefaring races combined arms in a unified front stand a very little chance of holding off the Reapers is they must be powerful in a way that's just hard to wrap your head around. It seems like that's going to require some sort of a special weapon of some sort,
That kind of leads us to the ending, and we've been roundabout in this, but at the end of Mass Effect 3, you spent the whole game building alliances, getting people who don't want to work together for an enormous counterattack that's primarily centered on retaking the Earth, which is one of the first planets to fall when the Reapers finally launch their invasion, and you bring in this immense fleet, and my feeling, and again, this is funny because you're not wrong and I'm not wrong. It's all about how you play through the game and the experiences you have. My feeling was Shepard was pretty good at defeating Reapers, though you only really face two or three of them in the game. Mm-hmm. He or she is better at kind of getting away with stuff that so that they won't catch you. But I remember thinking at the end, and the ending of Mass Effect 3 in my case was basically, and I've said this in other articles and I've said it in other podcasts, was basically, okay, we lost, and everyone when the game came out and there was the ending, there was this huge uproar across the internet about how terrible the ending was. And my feeling was, well, what did you expect? You're dealing with a race that's like 100 million years more advanced than your most advanced ally.
So I knew about this uproar, you know, when it was going on, but because I hadn't finished the game, I was very consciously avoiding any real information about it because I didn't want to spoil what happened at the end of the game for myself. And ironically enough, I didn't end up finishing Mass Effect 3 until after the additional ending patch had been released. So I never saw the ending that caused so much controversy. What was the complaint about the ending is what I'm not clear on.
Well,
I thought I'd heard that the complaint was it there's only three endings and it doesn't sufficiently reflect the choices that you've made and have enough variety, you know, given this, you know, the different paths that you could have taken to get there in the game, to only have these three endings was somehow unsatisfactory to people. That was at least one of the criticisms that I felt like I heard. But maybe was there what else?
I think that was basically it. You know, I think it was twofold. One, people felt that the three endings, which I'm pretty sure all three were available no matter how you made it through the game, didn't, when every other decision you make can massively affect who's alive, who's dead, what happens throughout. So two people, you and me, could have had almost completely different story paths through the game. You get to the end and everybody's going to get one of the same three endings. I think it was partly that people were upset that the ending's kind of a downer. And no matter what you choose, there's no happy ending. It's like join with the Reapers or destroy the Reapers, but that's going to destroy all the mass relays or something else that's going to kill everybody. And then, you know, the credits roll in at the very end.
Well, there's the third option, right? Which is everything's daisies except you kind of have to sacrifice yourself.
The ending I got, and I wasn't 100% clear on why I chose this. I just sort of walked down a hallway and the game ended. We fired the Crucible, and you know what the super weapon did was destroy the mass relays and made it impossible for the Reapers to, because they couldn't move that much faster than light either. So yeah, it would be impossible to sweep the whole galaxy, but it also makes it impossible for galactic civilization to be retained. And one of the things they added in the patch, when I don't know if they buckled to pressure from the outroar or not, but it says, okay, well, the mass relays weren't really destroyed, they were just very seriously damaged.
Really?
Yeah, that was, I just read that on Wikipedia, actually.
Oh, that's terrible. I mean, so I sat there when that decision between what to do at the end came up. It literally, I spent about 5 minutes just staring at my screen, agonizing over what I thought was the right thing to do. What would the Shepard that I've been playing do? What would the consequences of the decision be? And in sort of classic, you know, Paragon Jedi fashion, I decided to take the self-sacrificing route and do the thing where you fire the relay, but you become one with the signal or something like that. You basically throw yourself into the relay when it fires and you disintegrate, but you add, you know, you have, by doing that, you have some sort of omniscient control over what happens. I don't remember all the specifics, but basically it's literally like, you know, roses and daisies for everybody else in the entire galaxy after you do it. Like the Krogan are all happy and hugging everybody, and the, you know, like the, you know, everybody, you know, everybody lives, the Reapers die, the Mass Effect relays are still there, you know, and galactic civilization enters a period of unprecedented peace, prosperity, and cooperation or something like that, right? Except that Commander Shepard has voluntarily dissolved himself in a, you know, in the Crucible, I guess, is the downer there. But I, you know, I felt like I want to say two things. The first is that I think that the criticism that these three options are an unsatisfactorily diverse set of conclusions to the story doesn't carry weight with me. And the reason for that is that I really saw all of Mass Effect 3 as the conclusion to the Mass Effect series. And I think that they do a very effective job throughout the game of tying up the story lines that you care about and that you've created and invested in. And it's each of these sort of cameos where Miranda comes back and Kane comes back and Samara comes back and all these different characters that if you kept them alive through the first two games, they make their reappearances in the third game. Jacob's there. Everybody's there. And even if they're not playable characters in the third game, you get to see a resolution of their relationship with Shepard. And to me, that was satisfactory. And it was like, really, I'm not just looking, you're not concluding the story with the last cinematic sequence in the game. You're concluding the story with the whole game. And that's how you get resolution with the Krogan and the Sith, the Geth and the Quarians and all these other things happen throughout the course of the game. And it really all that's left at the very end is, so what happens with the Reapers? And that's why those three, outcomes are sufficient from my perspective.
I agree with you. I didn't agree with the uproar about the endings in general. I mean, to me, Mass Effect was really all about the journey and the decisions mm-hmm. you made. The conclusion was whether or not it was foregone, I thought was kind of irrelevant. You know, it's a 30-second cinematic at the end is not going to make or break like 100 hours of gameplay for me where yeah. I've built these relationships and made these friendships and lost people and fallen in love and committed genocide twice.
Well, I mean, it's I think it's conceivable that it could. It's certainly possible that it could have bungled it so badly that it just really made you, it just really undermined the whole rest of the experience. I just don't think that's what happened. But the other thing is, it was really interesting to me about the ending was that decision was a very difficult one that I spent a lot of time thinking about. It was in some ways sort of, a little heavy-handed. I mean, you go down the blue tunnel and make the blue decision, you know, the Paragon decision. You go down the red tunnel or make the Renegade decision, or you go down the green tunnel apparently and jump into the middle of the Crucible and sacrifice yourself. But the thing that really, really grabbed me at the end was that the game ended and on some level, I think it was unsatisfactory to me because I really just wanted to see what happened next, you know, like, and I think that that's a credit to the game.
Yeah.
But so I went online and I was like, well, what else could have happened? And I started looking at some of the other ending cinematics that were out there. And that's when I discovered the whole, indoctrination theory. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that?
I am. I was just going to bring it up. The Reapers have this power where they're sort of psychic. They can control biological minds slowly. And, if you're around a Reaper long enough, eventually you just start thinking the way the Reapers want you to think. And, I did the same thing you did. I went online after I finished the game and was poking around, and somebody with a lot more time than you or I apparently have
smarter than me at least. That's for sure.
Put together this 40-minute video explaining that Shepard had been indoctrinated by the Reapers almost from the beginning. And there are a lot of clues in the game that suggest that that might be accurate.
I mean, I found it to be a really compelling case. And, like, I guess, you know, I have other friends who are really into Mass Effect who said that they feel like either that it's been debunked or that BioWare has said that there's no truth to it, although I haven't heard that from BioWare. But mm-hmm. But like the case, particularly in what happens at the very end of the game, is so compelling let me put it this way. If the indoctrination theory is valid and the only correct answer is the one that involved, you know, the red renegade option of doing what you chose to do, and that the other two were sort of shills that were there to try and sucker Shepard into choosing something else, then if that's true, while I'm deeply disappointed in myself for not having noticed it and made the wrong decision, it's also to me a stroke of narrative genius on the part of the team at BioWare. So I mean, there's a part of me that I'm very conflicted about the indoctrination theory because I completely missed it, but I also think it would be genius if they actually pulled it off.
It would be. And after watching that video, I mean, I prefer to think that the indoctrination theory is accurate because it also explains. People were upset that your choices didn't make a difference at the end, and it's like, okay, well, if Shepard was indoctrinated by the Reapers, then at the end, as the video about the indoctrination theory makes clear, you're only seeing what the Reapers want you to see by that point. You're only making the decisions that the Reapers want you to make by that point, so your choices don't matter. And I thought it was incredibly clever and incredibly complex. If BioWare planned it that way, and like you, I've never heard from BioWare saying that they didn't plan it that way. There's a lot of evidence that's really well put together in the indoctrination theory that says, yeah, I mean, even in the very first Mass Effect, a character is talking about hearing voices in some parts of the ship and various effects that are specifically mentioned as part of Reaper indoctrination happen to you throughout the whole trilogy. So I think it's distinctly possible, and it's a sign of BioWare's really strong narrative skills that – you know, if it's not true, well, that's too bad. But if it is true, they planned this thing a lot more carefully than you know.
Yeah, and the single most compelling piece of evidence for me that supported the indoctrination theory is that only in one of the three final, because I don't agree that even in the indoctrination scenario does it not matter what you choose, because the nature of indoctrination is that it's insidious, it's subtle, and it's that you're not aware it's happening to you, but it's also not a perfect thing that you can fight back against it, and it takes time for it to be fully effective, and obviously Shepard's a very strong personality, and that the argument that I took away from the indoctrination video is that there was a right choice. It is the unappealing choice, which is the jump in the red tunnel and wipe out the Reapers and do irreparable damage to technology throughout the galaxy as a result of it, and that the Reapers explicitly don't want you to take that and therefore make the other two so much more appealing to you in an attempt to make you not take it. And then what happens is if you choose either of the other two scenarios, things turn out relatively rosy. And you get to go home feeling like you saved the galaxy, but that what I always envisioned that was as Reaper victory. Like, they successfully indoctrinate Shepard at that time, dissuade him from defeating them, and basically the Reapers win. If you go down the red tunnel, you do succeed in stopping the Reapers, and that's why you get that really brief cinematic at the very end that indicates that Shepard's still alive and he's waking up surrounded by a bunch of what looks like very Earth-like rubble. And you don't get that cinematic if you choose either of the other two things. And to me, that's hugely telling.
It's an interesting thing because I spent a lot of time thinking about Mass Effect, and perhaps the biggest compliment I can pay it is I've spent so much time thinking about the trilogy and kind of picking it apart in my mind, and the worst I can say about it is only small things didn't make sense. You know, like there's this mm-hmm. there's this concept of like the biological imperative, which is, you know, living species exist to propagate themselves. And the biggest logical complaint I could come up with about Mass Effect is the Reapers don't seem to follow that. It doesn't make any sense for a robot species who owns a galaxy to spend the vast majority of their time outside it. And they would get more power if they were inside a galaxy. They would be able to deal with spacefaring races one at a time if they were inside it. And so it's this tiny nitpicky thing. And of course, the Reapers aren't biological, so maybe they don't have that imperative. Mm-hmm. And I remember finally coming to the conclusion as I was thinking about it. It's like, if this is the worst I can say, that this fictional race doesn't adhere to an anthropological theory.
Yeah.
That's the sign of a game that's incredibly well thought out. And I think Mass Effect, one of the things that frustrated me, because there was this outrage over the ending, people didn't stop at the end of Mass Effect 3 and say, holy crap, this trilogy was hugely important for game narrative.
Yeah.
It really elevated it beyond what the vast majority, 99% of other games, even really good narrative games, have ever done in terms of making a true epic that can stand alongside other great narrative epics and other media.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you, you know, in almost every respect, and I think that it's a sign of great narrative, you know, whether you're talking about novels or films or whatever, but great narrative art and storytelling that they do have this sort of controversy that surrounds them and that people are compelled to talk about them and that they can be interpreted in different ways and that there is no clean, convenient answer. And I think it's a sign that this one was successful, that so many people cared so much, you know. I just think that a lot of people maybe didn't have the benefit of really, or didn't take the time to do the additional homework on all the other stuff they might have missed.
As we're talking about this, let's transition over to Halo 4, which, as I mentioned at the beginning, I haven't had the opportunity to play. But when we were talking on the phone planning this podcast, one of the points you made when you said, go out and get a copy of Halo 4 and play it because I want to talk about it in the context of Mass Effect, you said, let's talk about Mass Effect as this enormous success of sci-fi narrative, and I believe you said where you felt Halo 4 kind of dropped the ball.
I'm a huge fan of the Halo games and the Halo universe. I've played and beated every thing that they've put out, even Halo Wars, the Bungie game, the RTS that they did a while back. And I'm also a fan of the universe. And one of the things that and this is where the transmedia stuff comes in, and one of the big differences I see between Halo and Mass Effect, to their credit, I think Microsoft has done a really great job of extending Halo in particular into other media. There are novels. They had the Halo Legacy graphic or animated shorts that came out, sort of an Animatrix style release a couple years ago. There's the Forward Unto Dawn web series that came out before Halo 4, and actually sets up one of the characters that's in Halo 4. So I really like that they're doing all of that. But the big thing that I felt like they didn't do in the Halo, and really in the Halo series, or that they don't do is they don't do an effective job of summarizing the events outside of the medium that you're playing in a way that lets you be aware of them, even if you haven't gone and read or watched them yourself. So for instance, you know, in Halo 4, the first mate of the ship, Infinity that you encounter, it's a human ship. There's an officer, the first officer on there is a guy named Tom Lasky. And he's the main character of the Forward Unto Dawn series, which is a really well done web series that they released just before they launched the game, and which I definitely recommend that you watch. But that character, knowing that, having watched that series, seeing him in the game is cool, and you don't need to have seen that series to get that. But it just adds an extra cool factor to it, which is nice. Although there is a point in the game where Lasky says to Master Chief, "Never thought I'd see you again." Just total offhanded comment. Fine, and it works in the context of the game in terms of knowing what you know, which is that they had met briefly once before in the events that took place in the web series. Mass Effect gives you the Codex as a way to go back and refresh yourself on the things that you need to know in order to really fully appreciate what's happening in the story. Halo doesn't have that. And I think that that's a disservice to the fans. And it's a disservice to fans who haven't gone and found every scrap of Halo material that they can find, because it's such a trivial thing to do. It would have been very easy to have a codex in Halo and have an entry for Lasky and have a reference at that point that, oh, they crossed paths once before, so that when Lasky makes that comment, those players can still appreciate what the comment's about instead of being confused or perplexed by it. And I think that's just an example of a lot of stuff that there's a lot of really great, rich detail. I mean, the first thing I did, and I don't know if you've done this, but when I got Halo Reach. I got the collector's edition, and it comes with this beautiful bound journal that's written by Dr. Halsey, who is the woman who creates the Spartans in the Halo universe. And it's I opened up that game and literally spent the first, I don't know, hour and a half, 2 hours after I'd gotten Halo Reach reading Halsey's journal before I booted up the game. And once I did, the events that take place in Halo Reach are way more powerful and interesting and in context for you, because you can understand what's going on. And yet they don't really make that information available, even in a summary form, to people who are just playing the games. And I think that that's just a missed opportunity for Halo. And the, part of the Halo conversation I want to have is in the context of this larger universe, the fact that I found Halo 4 to be really dissatisfying from a narrative perspective, because the villain didn't make sense. It seemed like a contrivance to me. There were a lot of other issues about the relationship between humanity and the Covenant that were happening in Halo 4 that didn't seem consistent with any of the stuff that had happened at the end of Halo 3. You know, and I just felt like there were a lot of narrative holes and unanswered questions in Halo 4 that I didn't understand. It may be that those are answered in one of the books. I haven't read the Halo books. It may not be. I don't know. And I think that that's a failure on the part of Microsoft, that I shouldn't be left, especially considering how passionate I am about the universe, how much of that extra material I am familiar with. I shouldn't be left there playing Halo 4, which is the flagship incarnation of this property, in the market today, and feeling like it was a narrative failure, you know? So that to me is what I'd like to talk about is some of that stuff. But I suspect you may have a fair bit of homework to do before.
I think I do. I am not as much of a Halo fan because the controls drive me crazy, and I'm still debating whether or not to replace the seventh Xbox. So we'll have to see. But I think it's interesting in terms of a transmedia conversation, which we should also have another time. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. what was done right, what was done wrong, what game developers can do to integrate more of that, whether or not they want to go across multiple media or build a franchise, how you can integrate an understanding of the story and the narrative and the themes so that everyone gets it, so everyone has access to it if they want it.
Yeah. So here's my request for you, Matthew.
Okay.
Go ahead and before you decide if you want to play Halo 4 because of your complaints about the controls, have you played the other Halo games?
I played one mostly in split screen, two mostly in split screen. So I'm a little iffy on the stories. I got three and got about halfway through it, and just the way Master Chief jumps made me so angry that I put it down and never went back. So my knowledge of the universe is pretty limited.
All right. Well, so read a go find a Wikipedia summary of the first three games.
Okay.
And then read Halsey's journal. See if you can find a copy of Halsey's journal somewhere, and watch the Halo Legacy animated videos and forward unto Dawn, and then decide for yourself if you want to play Halo 4 or not. But that's all homework you can do without having to jump or shoot anything.
You keep giving me homework, man. I haven't given you any assignments in a long time.
Whose fault is that?
I can't even think of any. I don't have any for you, but I'll come up with one. I'll get you and your little dog too.
All right, fine. That sounds like a plan. All right. Well, I mean, it's been a good conversation. I'm really glad we finally got to have it. I always enjoy these, so hopefully we'll get to have another one soon.
Me too. It was awesome. I've wanted to discuss Mass Effect, and this is probably a better format to do it in than, you know, my usual 45,000 word epics that nobody rereads. So this may be a longer podcast, but hopefully it was interesting for everybody, and thanks for staying with us.